region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Amy Loria. Tonight, we start your evening off talking trash with Caller City's favorite journalist, Luke Stoddard-Nathan. Highlights from local happenings.
Next, correspondent Megan Marone has more fabulous physics facts with the solar sloop sailor, Dr. David Borton.
Afterwards, we'll hear our weekly Nature Lab segment. Producer Elizabeth Press sat down with Angela Beeler to talk about her upcoming performance of MG, I Want a Baby, Reimagined.
Later on, CollarWorks radio host Justin Baker interviews guest Patrick Tyne, new arts contributor for the Times Union.
Lastly, correspondent Gary McCary introduces Hudson Mohawk Magazine listeners to Ann Perillo to discuss the Eel Project and counting eels in the Postenkill. Let's start the show off with some headlines.
New state requirements for handling excess food could reduce the state's carbon footprint and help address hunger in New York. Starting in 2022, large food generators, including supermarkets, colleges, hotels, and sporting venues, will be required to donate leftover edible food. The remaining scraps will need to be prepared as animal feed or compost if a recycling facility is within 25 miles. Food waste currently makes up about 18% of the municipal solid waste in New York. Furthermore, food that ends up in landfills will eventually release methane, a harmful greenhouse gas.
The wind and cold didn't keep golfers away from hitting the links this morning, opening the season at Freer Park Golf Course. The first nine holes were designed in 1931 by Robert Trent Jones and opened that same year. In 1964, the back nine were added to bring the number to 18. For residents of Troy, those 18 holes will cost only $20, and for non-residents, a mere $28. To book a tee time or to purchase season passes, go to www.troyny.gov.
On Tuesday, Albany Law School, SUNY Research Foundation, and SUNY Polytechnic formalized an agreement in which interdisciplinary teams of engineering, business, and law students will work on commercialization of new inventions and products. The idea is to expose those students to the commercialization of technology research.
The results of a new poll released Tuesday by the Siena Research Institute are out. The Times Union is reporting that New Yorkers are not happy about a $71,000 raise state lawmakers approved for Governor Andrew M. Cuomo at the tag end of the recent state budget negotiation. This raise from $179,000 to $200,000 was recommended by a special compensation panel and sets Cuomo up to receive $250,000 a year in 2021. Figures show that 62% of registered voters, including 54% of Democrats, opposed the legislature's decision. About a third of respondents supported the measure. Support for the pay bump is comparable to the 37% of voters who believe Cuomo is doing an excellent or good job as governor.
Renee Fahey of Selkirk will represent the Capital Region in the annual Jefferson Awards for Public Service in June in Washington, D.C. She was among eight finalists for the award and was honored on Monday at the Century House Restaurant in Latham. Fahey, along with her husband, has been meeting the needs of the Capital Region's homeless since late 2016 when they began providing soup and sandwiches on the streets of Albany one night a week.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary. In a city of inquisitive minds, there's none to compare with our guest, journalist Luke Stoddard-Nathan, creator of Troy Letter. Welcome back, Luke.
Hey, thanks for having me back. In this past Troy Letter, and this covering last week, one of the big things that I provide a lot of details on was an informational meeting of the city council that was held up in Lansingburg. This is a sort of public meeting that happens sort of not with any fixed schedule, but periodically where the city council the mayor, and then also all the department heads of the city of the city's administration. Although some didn't show at this particular meeting, but that's at least the sort of intent. Come to a meeting, and then people from the members of the public can just ask them questions, sort of whatever they want. So it's a really rare opportunity for the public to get a look, kind of at the inner workings of city government. And indeed, like a good maybe 100 people attended this meeting. And one of the big things that came up a lot was issues with waste disposal, like, you know, trash, you know, no surprise, like people unhappy about, say, just trash, you know, spread about their neighborhood, or littering, or this and that. One more sort of specific grievance, I guess, was around the city's new bulk refuse pickup charge. It used to be, to the extent that the city even had a policy about this sort of thing, it was sort of just like, put it out and it will get taken. And then as part of the budget process, the city, when it created this new sort of garbage fund to house the per unit trash fee, it also created this new fee where to get bulk items picked up, you know, like mattresses, fridges, furniture. You kind of call ahead, and if you're in an owner occupied building, at least, you pay $25 for up to 2 cubic yards of those bulk items to be removed. If you're in a non-owner occupied building, you pay $25 plus like a per unit kind of, or sorry, a per item kind of fee, depending on what the item is. And the city is sort of defended this, or at least the deputy mayor defended this during the meeting, by saying that, you know, it kind of makes sure that whoever's using this particular service the most pays for it, rather than it being kind of spread out amongst all taxpayers. So I'm not sure if that explanation landed or not. She gave the example, like, if I put out a mattress, there's no reason why all of you should have to pay. One resident even kind of objected, saying that, like, by charging for this bulk disposal, it's going to encourage people to actually dump their stuff more to try to skirt paying the fee. Mm-hmm. And the deputy mayor responded by saying that the city's going to be placing trail cams, which I guess are just like cameras that maybe just take a picture. Like, have you ever seen, like, on, like, when people catch, like, amazing photos of wildlife in the woods or something?
Oh,
like,
yeah, sure.
Like a bear in a backyard, or like, it's because that it's just a camera that it's motion activated or whatever, and it takes takes a picture. Apparently the city's in the process of securing some of those and putting them in places where there's known to be, like, a lot of dumping happening, illegal dumping. So I guess stay tuned for trail cams. Maybe there
pictures
will be some cool footage.
Wildlife.
Maybe you could foil request through the Freedom of Information Law pictures, all the pictures that came up from these trail cams, and see if you can catch some cool poses or something. I don't know. That might be a difficult foil. Some other little newsy items that came out of this meeting. Work has started on the South Troy pool. This is one of the pools that the city council has authorized bonding for, to the tune of, I forget how much, but over $1 million for this one pool to repair the South Troy pool. The mayor has set a target of opening the facility by July 1st. So that's the goal. It's an election year. I would suspect they'll make it happen, but I guess, you know, there can be all sorts of challenges with construction, so I guess we'll see what happens there. The other pool, the Lansingburg pool, or the Knickerbocker Park pool, that's also been closed for a couple of years now. That park is a little trickier because it's owned by a nonprofit that technically leases it to the city for like a nominal fee. So the city basically needs the blessing of that nonprofit to be able to rebuild the pool, especially because the city wants to rebuild the pool in a different location within the park. In the comprehensive plan, the city has laid out this grand vision for kind of changing the configuration of that park quite a bit. But in order to do that, it needs the blessing of this nonprofit. Apparently, the nonprofit has at least consented to the exploration of moving this pool. So the deputy mayor said that they'll have some concepts to bring back to us, whatever, you know, that means, within the next month or two. The city, this is another kind of thing that I guess I knew and heard, and from looking at the budget I knew, but it hadn't really sunk in. It came up, the topic of code enforcement often comes up at these sort of meetings, and indeed it came up at this meeting last week. The city only has 4 code enforcement officers who are actually like going out. They have more people working in that office, but 4 people who actually go and say inspect the buildings and, you know, look around and see if there's any violations or whatever. So that's 4 officers for, I think the mayor said there's about 21,000 parcels of property across the city. So divide that up by 4. That's still quite a heavy burden. And, you know, the mayor said that he said something noncommittal, like we could use more code enforcement officers, but you'd need to pay for them, you know. So, you know, maybe your taxes would have to go up if you want. You know, I guess I would probably push back on that and say, you know, there's probably some areas of the budget that maybe could be accordingly, you know, cut to be able to, if residents decided that was what they really wanted to see, or if the mayor decided that, you know, he really wanted to hire more code enforcement officers, it doesn't seem like it'd be beyond the realm of possibility. It's not as if code enforcement officers, especially at an entry level, are making, you know, gobs of money. Nevertheless, and the mayor did mention that, you know, recently, the city council approved legislation that I guess he's signed by now that prohibits people from obtaining certificates of occupancy or building permits if they have outstanding code violations or outstanding if they owe money for taxes or whatever to the city. Okay. So he described that as like one tool in the many tools that you need to combat blight, which is, you know, such a prevalent kind of thing in the city of Troy. Speaking of, blight or just the absence of any sort of structure whatsoever, I'll just mention briefly that the city late last week, issued an RFQ, that's a request for qualifications, from potential developers of the One Monument Square site. This is the former site of City Hall in downtown. It's been a giant crater for a number of years now. A succession of proposals have been failed for one reason or another, the most recent being the Bowtie Cinemas idea that was basically killed off by a lawsuit brought by a neighboring property owner that raised a bunch of different issues that sort of stymied or at least delayed the project so much that the developing team decided to walk away. The long and short of it is that the city is seeking a developer to partner with it and or oversee it. They want to see the developer at least build a 2-level parking garage. This is all in visions that were already kind of established through a public workshop that happened last year with a separate consultant that the city hired. 2 levels of parking with a kind of public plaza on top, some sort of staircase, kind of a showpiece staircase that leads from the Monument Square side of the site down to the river, because it's sort of this 2-level kind of site, and then buildings on top of varying heights, up to I think 8 stories or something like that, but kind of around the public space on the top. The question, of course, becomes how do you pay for all that? The city says that it wants to retain some ownership of the site, but maybe allow the developer to own the buildings on top of the site through some sort of long-term lease. It seems like the city's open to a bunch of different permutations in terms of ownership. It's kind of complicated. It could involve condominiums and all sorts of different structures. It doesn't seem like the city's settled on any of them. But, you know, developers are invited to submit proposals. They're going to be evaluated by a committee that's kind of devoted to this site. It's made up of city residents as well as city staff. Stay tuned, I guess. The response deadline is May 10th. So if you're a developer out there, I guess apply if you're interested in getting involved in Monument Square, which is sort of notorious at this point.
Right.
Where can people go to stay on top of Little Ogle News?
tinyletter.com/Troy_letter, or email me luke.s.nathan@gmail.com and say, I want Troy Letter, and I'll sign you up.
Don't forget to look out for his Patreon page.
Yes, I'm also always looking out for people to financially support me in everything that I do. So you can do that as well if you want.
Luke, thank you for what you do. Thanks for joining us. We look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you for having me.
Solar boat builder David Borton is back with another episode of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. In this edition, he and Megan Marone ponder who will captain the Solar Sal, his solar commercial cruise ship that will dock in Troy this summer, And Dr. Borton describes how he and his wife observed the Coast Guard testing their boat to make sure it was Hudson River ship shape.
We are back with Dr. David Borton. How are you, David?
I'm very good, Megan. How are you?
I'm doing well. I heard that you have an update for us on a boat that may see the Erie Canal this summer.
Yes, that's correct. The first ever U.S. Coast Guard inspected solar, 100% solar commercial tour boat is getting close to being Coast Guard certified in Kingston, New York. And I was down there Thursday, and on Thursday doing last few things, because on Friday the Coast Guard came up and did a stability test. And a stability test is basically just seeing that the boat floats upright, and if you put a moment, a torque, a force on one side, tends to tip the boat over, that the force that is considered a large force for the boat does not, in fact, tip the boat over. And so that test was coming on Friday, and on Thursday, those of us who were working on the boat noticed that there was this burning smell. And we didn't see where it was coming from. We looked across the river. There was nothing there. We looked up and down the river. We looked along the shore. And we really didn't see anything that was burning. And later in the afternoon, somebody picked up a cardboard box that was in the sink. The boat has a sink, and this little box was in the sink. And there were little burn marks on the box. And having been in solar energy for 30 years, I knew right away that what happened was that the bowl of the sink that was highly chrome polished was reflecting the sunlight to a point. It was a concentrator. Just like a magnifying glass can concentrate sunlight and start a fire, this bowl was concentrating sunlight onto the box, and it didn't catch into flame, but it certainly started things smoldering. And so there was a solar concentrator in the boat, inadvertently cooking a cardboard box.
Was this stressful for you in the middle of the inspection?
Oh, no, this was the day before the inspection.
Oh.
Okay,
I thought that this was, you know, one of those stories where you're in the middle of your driving test or you're in the middle of your inspection test and some kind of embarrassing snafu happens.
Okay, so for the inspection test, my wife and I were there, and we pulled up two plastic chairs and sat in them and watched what was happening at the dock in front and below us. And so we had very good seats. And what happened was that the crew made a wooden platform in the boat, put with 60 50-pound concrete blocks in the boat. And that was to represent people in the boat. And then measurements were taken as to where the water line was. And the blocks were moved to one side. And as the blocks were moved to one side, what did the boat do?
Tip.
It tipped. It tilted. And the question was, how far is it going to tip? And there was a calculation made that said it's going to tip to about here, and there was a piece of tape put on the side of the boat where it was going to about tip to, and the boat tipped not quite to where that was, and the boat passed the test. And so here we were sitting there watching people move concrete blocks and making measurements on the boat and coming to the conclusion that the boat passed the stability test for the U.S. Coast Guard for the first ever 100% solar-powered commercial tour boat in the United States.
Wow. How did you feel after it passed?
Well, it was great. You know the result's going to happen, but I assume that anything could go wrong, right? Well, it's really hard to go wrong with physics, and nothing, of course, did go wrong, and so it was very nice at the end of the test when all the check boxes were checked and the answer was yes, the boat passed the stability test.
So you and your wife are on the dock, you're on the shore, and the boat is docked.
Right.
And what color is the boat painted now?
The boat is a sort of an off-white, very nice.
Okay.
And the solar panels are sort of blue on the top, and that's very nice. And the shape of the boat is a classic shape from 1906. It's based on when boats were first powered by what was then a naphtha engine, and naphtha engines were very heavy and very low powered, so the hull had to be very efficient, and the shape of the boat was a classic shape that was very efficient in going through the water.
Wow. Are we thinking the same shape as the solar cell?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
So is there a sleeping compartment in this boat?
Well, this is a tour boat, and people on tours typically don't want to go more than an hour or two. And so there is not overnight compartment. Now, there's nothing to say you couldn't sleep on the floor, you know, take along a sleeping bag, but that's not what the boat is designed for. It is designed to take a crew of two, a captain and a crew, single crewman, and 28 passengers.
Cool. You know, you've described to me before, I'm not sure if you can comment on this, that one of the tricky things that you've encountered is that some of the men who've come as inspectors from the Coast Guard don't necessarily have knowledge of the solar power.
Yes. The problem is that electric technology in cars, in buses, and in boats is relatively new. And in boats, the federal regulation has not kept up with electric boats. But there aren't solar electric boats. So there are no regulations for solar electric boats. So the question is, how do you handle that? And that's a question for the Coast Guard, and they are between the federal regulations and the physics of people like myself who have these boats that actually work. And we expect them to be inspected and get a certificate of inspection. And there's really no federal regulations that cover this kind of boat.
So do you have any other updates for us on the boat? Are you getting very excited thinking about people leaving? We're going to have a new riverfront park in Troy, and the boat could pull right up and take people out for tours. Are you getting excited thinking about people doing that?
Yes, I am. And in fact, last weekend at the Maritime Museum in Kingston, there was a sailing event. A women's sailing group got together, and at one point, the speaker didn't show. I don't remember why the speaker wasn't able to come. And so one of the captains of the boat took at least two, maybe three, boatloads of these sailing women out on the solar sail and took them for a ride up and down. And I don't know whether it was just the Rondout River or also the Hudson River. And everybody loved it. I think you know what it's like to be on a solar boat. And so that was an experience that these wind-type sailors got to experience sailing on a solar boat.
I mean, just to show off, do I know what it's like to be on a solar boat? Do you remember? I got to captain.
You were not exactly captain. You were the helmsman.
What's that song from the 80s? Give me one moment in time. Give me that one moment in time.
Well, you did very well driving the boat, because the boat is, I'm going to say, very nice to drive.
Well, you and Britton got nervous with my steering just at one point.
Well, that's okay.
I'd never steered a solar vessel before.
Well, that's all right, because most people haven't. And another thing, if you've driven an electric car, you notice the difference between an electric car and a gasoline car. And the same thing with an electric boat. And it's even better when it's a solar electric boat.
I think you both thought that I was going to go directly into the lock.
Well, it depends what you mean by into the lock. The boat needs to go into the lock to go up and down, but not
crash.
And
it did. It was smooth sailing all the way with Captain Megan. Yes.
Yeah, so. Captain is a technical word for the Coast Guard.
And you are a captain.
I am a master. There's a captain which can take out six passengers, and then there is a master that can take out more than six passengers.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, do you have anything else, any other updates?
Well, I've got another boat that's an experiment, but we'll save that for after the experiments had a chance to get in the water and be tried.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Barton.
Well, Megan, it's always a pleasure.
That was correspondent Megan Marone with doctor and solar boat builder David Borton.
For those just tuning in, I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Amy Loria. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Next up, our Nature Labs segment. Hudson Mohawk magazine producer Elizabeth Press sat down with Angela Beeler to talk about her upcoming performance of MG, aka I Want a Baby Reimagined. They touch on topics of labor, pregnancy, and eugenics.
You are listening to the Hudson Mohawk magazine. I'm Elizabeth Press, and I'm here today with Angela Beeler, a PhD candidate in the Electronic Arts Program at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. We're here to talk about her current work. And Angela, why don't we just dive right into it? Tell us what you're working on.
Thanks for having me. I am working on a project that will be presented at MPAC on April 26th, Friday, 7 p.m. And it has the title MG, aka I Want a Baby Reimagined. It's an experimental piece based around a play that was written in 1926 in the former Soviet Union by Sergei Tretyakov called I Want a Baby. And it centers on a cultural worker, Milda Grignow, who decides that she wants to contribute a new proletarian to the growing society. But she wants to do so without a husband, without a partner, without a father involved, and goes about using eugenically informed methods to do this. Meanwhile, she's creating a communal nursery. So the whole play is a rather chaotic and humorous exploration of themes of eugenics, reproduction, gender, and sexuality at that time.
How did you land on this Tretyakov play, and what are you doing in reimagining it?
Mm-hmm. So I was doing some research related to the Soviet Union. My father had been a member of the Communist Party for quite a long time, and my parents were both involved. And I was doing some research related to some pins and material culture, and I stumbled upon this play around the time that I was considering having a child. I'm in a queer relationship and was going to go about doing so through artificial reproduction. And I found this play and I thought, wow, what a perfect opportunity to explore these themes historically around the Soviet experiment, while also thinking in a contemporary sense about what it means to intentionally attempt to have a child using technology, using artificial reproductive technology. So my reimagining is, I'm calling it an experimental queer interpretation of the play. So we've taken the play and we've condensed it, we've cut characters, we've collapsed characters. And I don't want to give away too much, but there are some overlays to give context to what was going on at the time, and then some sort of contemporary moments that are laid over the play or inserted into the play. The play centers on this woman who wants to have this baby, but there is a giant hole in the middle of the play, which is her experience of pregnancy. So, which I think is a big oversight of this person, Tretyakov, who wrote the play, who would have never experienced this thing, you know, just kind of leaping over the labor that goes into getting pregnant, carrying a life, bearing a life, birthing a life, and then continuing to take care of that life. All of that goes into that. Breastfeeding, not breastfeeding, having trouble with doing that, having to constantly think about taking care of another dependent person. And so it's a big gap for me, for him to have written this play that, you know, is looking at themes of production and reproduction, and yet totally ignoring, I rather flippantly, I mean, it's a funny play, but it's just, there are moments for me where it's like, oh, just breastfeed the kid and then hand it off to the children's home. And I think that that is a big leap over this very important site of this labor that falls on caretakers or mothers or other parent-identified people.
So you mentioned eugenics. You've just talked about labor and pregnancy. I was wondering if you could dive a little bit deeper into, like, what is eugenics and mm-hmm. what you're discovering in revisiting the play I Want a Baby by Tretyakov.
Sure. So eugenics is a term that was coined in the late 1800s by this sort of Victorian do-it-all inventor, Francis Galton, who is actually a cousin of Charles Darwin. And other people had thought about this concept, but he coined this term, which is about using a scientific method, a scientific outlook, in order to influence your progeny, what is happening at conception, in order to have a better product, a better baby. And what is a better baby? That comes with all sorts of social categorizations and perspectives on science, ability, mental outlook, class, race, gender, sexual, all of these things are contained when you look at a baby and say, I want to make a better baby. This movement sort of grew from around the late 1800s and had a real height in the 1910s and 1920s all around the world. The United States, if you look at U.S. immigration policy as it came out in the 1900s, you know, 1918, 1922, it is directly related to these questions of eugenics. What is a good human and who will produce a good human? Who should you let into the country? So it's very much from its inception in various countries tied to, you know, race and class, national origin. So who do we not let in the country and who do we let in and want in? And in the Soviet Union, eugenics was applied in similar ways. It was connected there to, okay, we're envisioning this totally new socialist society that had never been seen in the world before, and thinking about, well, what kinds of humans are going to carry forward this vision of these ethics within the Soviet Union. So there were a lot of similarities and a lot of crossover, but there was a lot of talk around producing laborers, producing people who are not going to be doing socially antisocial behaviors, drinking, gambling, promiscuity, and then also who's going to be a strong contributing laborer, proletarian to the society.
On a similar note, there were at this time better baby contests. Mm-hmm. This is something that you're playing into in your reimagining of the script.
So the final scene of the original play is called Children on Show. And it is this kind of chaotic scene where everyone is gathered at the clubhouse in order to witness a contest of the healthiest baby. These contests existed all across the United States, again, in the 1910s and 1920s in particular. Even if you look at, I think it was 1926, maybe 1928, the Scaghtikoke Fair, there was a better baby contest, or there were fitter family. It was just this way to bring people into looking at health and aptitude and how to judge if you're being a proper parent to have a child, but also to influence parents who are going to become parents to select proper mates so that they could have this, you know, the perfect type of baby. And these questions still exist today. I mean, the other end of eugenics is, sure, it had this heyday in the 1910s and 1920s. And if you read newspapers from that time, and then you start going into the late 1920s, into the 1930s, and the World War II and the realization of what was going on in Nazi Germany, the world sort of turned away from eugenics, associated it with the things that the Nazi regime was implementing. And actually, they took a lot of what they did straight from the United States policies, because the U.S. instituted policies of sterilization for people who were so-called feeble-minded. It's too much to get into now, but it is related directly to these things that society deemed as not the type of citizen we want. And so it was a policy of control. And yes, I'm not sure about exactly like how better baby, fitter family contests exist today, but certainly sterilization has existed into, for instance, in states like California, into the mid-2000s, at the very least, in relation to prisoners. So the world turns its back on eugenics, but part of what I'm looking at is the way that eugenics never disappeared. We may have, you know, said, okay, we don't want to associate with that, but it's the ideas behind it, the science that's there, is still within the ways that we look at tests on babies, questions of does a child have a so-called disability or not, you know, what's going on with their genes. And then, like me, if you are choosing artificial reproduction technology as a queer person, a single person, whatever leads you to that, if you go to select your sperm, for instance, the categories of selection are directly related to ethnicity, country of origin. You choose eye color, you choose hair color, you're choosing skin color. The donors answer questions around their mental capacities, their IQ tests. These are all things that are directly linked to eugenics.
So interesting. So deep, so many layers. Angela Beeler, we're quickly running out of time, but I just wanted to give you one last word here today on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. You've brought so many people into this project from the community. Tell us again where it is and what you're going to be doing.
Mm-hmm. So yes, MPAC here in Troy, New York, on Friday, April 26th at 7 p.m. It's free and open to the public. It's MG, aka I Want a Baby Reimagined. And yes, these are deep and complex themes, but it's going to be a fun, I think, rollicking presentation of a condensed version of this play. We have a cast of over 12 people. We have sound and dance choreography and, you know, video and a whole host of things that a great number of people are bringing in. If you go to the MPAC website and look on the calendar there, then you can see everyone who is acting, dancing, making projections, making sounds. And I think it's going to be great.
Thank you, Angela.
Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Press and visual artist Angela Beeler regarding her upcoming performance.
Colorworks radio host Justin Baker interviews guest Patrick Tyne, new arts contributor for the Times Union, about his impressions of the 41st Photo Regional and the Lab Space Show NSFW, both held at Colorworks Gallery in Troy, New York.
Hey, this is Colorworks Radio, and I'm your host, Justin Baker. With me this week is Patrick Tyne, a new contributor to the TU, art critic, reviewer, extraordinaire. Patrick, how you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm excellent. So first off, I just want to say thank you for the very kind review you did of the 41st Photo Regional, which is at Colorworks right now.
Well, it was just tremendous work.
All right. That is very kind, and I wanted to maybe get a little bit more of your thoughts of the show and also things that you didn't get to in your review. Of course, if people want to check out the review, they can go online. What else did you think, or what else was out there?
Well, you know, there were, I think it was 15 artists. I had 850 words, so you kind of do the math. You can't get to everybody, so that's why I said in the very beginning of the review, everything here is good, and any preconceived notion you might have about a show that is curated through an open entry process that you think you might be getting something that is substandard or it's amateur, throw that out of your mind, because that's absolutely not what's going on at Colorworks. I was taken by a lot of different things that I saw that I didn't get a chance to see, including some stuff that wasn't actually part of the photo regional, but was at the gallery and was also opening that night, such as there was the NSFW exhibit in the lab,
right,
where it was just the more avant-garde, young, weirder stuff. It wasn't necessarily photography. There was Havana Louis, with a piece that involved a photograph of her midriff and then a very oddly, very kind of disconcertingly posed glob of pizza dough.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was Carolyn Smith's Green Girl, which was a stop motion animated claymation film that featured a lovingly rendered clay sex shop. And I think that show really has a chance. It should really be on HBO as an adapted series. So I just wanted to get that out there because I didn't get to that at all in the review.
Sure.
And I just, there wasn't room to do it justice and do justice to the artists.
Yeah. And just for people listening, the lab is a extra space we have at the far end of the gallery that sometimes we use for the show, like the bigger show in the main gallery, but we also have that open for younger curators to come in and propose a project and put it on. So I think, you know, for us, we loved what they did back there.
It's really good. I mean, it's you know, if you're there, you got to see it. As far as stuff I didn't get to, I just want to mention some of the stuff that I really like, just to highlight again. Maybe the best piece in the whole exhibit. I know that there were, you know, there was a jury that voted on it, and he didn't get one of them. But Kobe Berger had a great photograph called Albany Super Storage, mm-hmm. which is, I know a little bit of his work. We were briefly classmates, but it's just, you know, this kind of anonymous place you've driven by a million times in Albany and have never thought twice about. And he just saw something else and posed a few objects in the frame and just created this, not disconcerting, but moving and weird and thought-provoking image. You know, there were boxing gloves and there was a string of pearls, and it just was... It was so. I don't know Kobe that well, but it reflected something in his sensibility, and it reflected a level of craftsmanship and a sense of humor and a deadpan style that I just really liked. And I know he's going for an MFA now. And if you can prognosticate as an art critic who's only written two reviews, I would say that's a person to watch over the months and years.
Sure.
I was also taken, you know, some of the people went in many directions with what photography and image making can be. You did your vaporous day glow geometries. Hannah Alsdorf went in a different direction. She worked in cyanotype. She was one of the artists I was really unhappy I wasn't able to work into the actual review, partially because I didn't want to inadvertently insult the technique that she used, what she decided to make a cyanotype of.
Right.
You know, a cyanotype is one of the earliest photographic processes. It's you basically make an imprint of an object on photosensitive paper, and it's ringed in cyan blue. And it's really, working in that medium means your heart getting back to almost the prehistory of photography. And she must have had that in her mind when she created what could be called kind of primitive or almost childlike images that really worked. You know, there was a flower, there was the outline of a bird, and I don't want to say primitive and childlike as if, you know, that also means unsophisticated, because it isn't. And I was really taken by it, but I didn't know how to work that in and have people get the wrong impression. So I can do it better by explaining it, verbally. But that piece was called Bleu Fleur One.
Right.
And, definitely a good piece.
I like that that photo a lot. You know, one thing was I had felt like I wish there was more of them to get a range or just kind of a better idea. You know, ColorWorks was our first time hosting the show, and we wanted to approach it in a way that was somehow different or somehow... you know, like a little more what we do in terms of the gallery and our programming. So we were excited to take it on. We asked some jurors from New York, the gallery, I forget the name of the gallery, Front Room Gallery.
Yeah.
Ken Ragsdale, one of our board members, had a connection, so we went with that. And I was hoping... like maybe it seemed like a little bit like the space wasn't as considered in how big it was, and the piece you're talking about is kind of small and almost seemed a little dwarfed in the space.
It was a little lost in the space, and you know, looking back on it, maybe that was like a valid criticism I could have put in the piece. But when you're looking at a selection of 15 different artists, it's impossible to have a thematic unification when everyone is just submitting what they think their best piece is.
Right, right.
And a cyanotype like that, and work that is so delicate like that, it's hard to stand out there. And I think it's brave that she chose that piece rather than maybe something that might pop more, because you know, that means she has a real faith in her craftsmanship, which I think is wonderful. You mentioned that the it was curated by two people from New York City.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't really want to devote the column inches to meditating or speculating on the fact that, like, do we need to call New York City Is it like, do you need to, you know, call up to the big leagues to get serious, you know, people? Because they're just as good. There would have been just as good people in, that are local that could have curated the show.
Right.
I was wondering, I mean, what was the, you know, there was a thought process there.
We had a bunch of ideas. You know, I had ideas to go more kind of regional with the curator. I had some ideas for someone out in Western, like Ithaca, a former professor of mine, Nick Molnar. I was curious to ask him.
I mean, I thought our friend Bill Yeager would have been a great
curator. Have probably done a great job. And, you know, would have been a much different show. I mean, it was interesting.
I mean, it's not that it was bad or you know, I'm trying to, you know, that we have some kind of little brother syndrome to New York City, but it's it was an interesting choice.
Yeah. Well, you know, the show is so rooted in the history of this region. This is the 41st iteration of it. So, you know, as a region, like, we believe and we support this show, that it should be here. We keep doing it. You know, these institutions keep taking it on. So there's that. And, you know, I don't know if we have to, you know, pay homage to it every year by, you know, protecting it or whatever. It's curious, you know, it's good to get outside looks at what's going on here.
And you know, the artists probably, appreciate it too, because it's, you know, everybody wants to go to New York City.
Nobody
wants to stay here forever necessarily. Most people at least.
Right.
So that's, so you really are helping the artists that way. It's not,
right,
you know, there's no clash, there's no ego or anything. So, on, so if really, from the artist's perspective, it's probably really, really good.
I mean, you know, and I guess in our defense, or you know, one angle we'd have as a, you know, an institution, Collar Works, is that, you know, we can say, like, you know, show your work, you know, or send your work to us, and at least, at the very least, these, you know, a gallery from New York will look at it and. Give it whatever.
And the idea that, you know, it's just like Collar Works is the perfect balance between other galleries in the area that have maybe a slightly higher threshold for entry, or, you know, require you to pay something. I know that there's one like that. I think Collar Works really does it.
I think it was a small fee.
The best small fee, but anyway.
If I can remember.
But it's good work done right.
All right. Well, thank you, Patrick. That's all we got. Love to have you on again. Pleasure having you here. And as always, go to Collar Works. You can check out the 41st Photo Regional in person. And also, there's Everyday Perfection at the Albany International Airport, which looks like a great show. I haven't made it yet.
And people forget that there's a gallery there, and it's always worth your
time. Right. How many airports have a great gallery?
Of course.
All right. Thank you again, Patrick.
Thank you.
That was Collar Works radio host Justin Baker with guest Patrick Tyne of the Times Union.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Garrett McCary introduces our listeners to Ann Perillo, host and producer of Schenectady Today in and around the Capital Region, one of the longest-running public access TV programs in the country. They discuss the Eel Project and counting eels in the Post and Kill.
It's Tuesday morning. I am in the Addy Theater, third floor, Proctor's in Schenectady. There's a table set up for registration. Mary Lou Samaha and Marie Balak check me in. Janice Walls checks to see if the graphics I sent are correct. I will be in segment 5 of Schenectady Today in and around the Capital Region, a public access television program produced at Open Stage Media. There are 3 cameras. The new technical director, Katie DiRico, is aligning her shots with the floor manager, Malcolm Cogan. The guests are invited to sit with the audience. We're about to begin. Okay, I'll say it, though no one really says it in television. Lights, camera, action.
Welcome to Schenectady Today in and around the Capital Region. I'm so happy you're joining us today. We've got a really great show today with lots of interesting information. You might want to get a pad out and start making some notes about some of this that we're going to be discussing today. We're going to be starting out with an attorney, and we're going to be going to the legal quarter and finding out about the new laws that are coming up and what's going on. And we may ask them a few questions from out in left field somewhere. And then we're going with Habitat for Humanity to find out about their community symposium that's coming up. We're very fortunate to have an international award-winning photojournalist joining them as well. Then the Girl Scouts will be talking about camping. What a great way for kids to spend the summer is to do some camping. And then we're going to be talking with Zeb Schmidt, who is the program director of Open Stage Media, just to kind of check out what's going on here at Open Stage Media, which is where we're filming. And then we're going to be talking about, did you know there's an eel project? Yes, there is. DEC has an eel research project. We're going to learn all about that.
Schenectady Today features people from all walks of life. You might tune in to see David Kaczynski, brother of the Unabomber, the actors in a local theater production, or Sawyer Fredericks, the winner of The Voice TV show. You might hear from the last surviving member of the Bird expedition to Antarctica, listen to a children's choir, a jazz band, or a folk duet, find out what's happening at the Museum of Innovation and Science. You might even see a live llama. More likely, you'll hear what volunteers from your community nonprofit organizations are doing.
I went through all of your photos, I think almost all of them, and I was just like amazed at some of your photos. They're so gritty.
Yes, gritty.
Gritty.
Well, that's what poverty is. Poverty is gritty.
Yeah.
Poverty is hard, and it's hard to find your way out of poverty, which is where part of the solution is Habitat for Humanity feels is home ownership and the self-investment and the self-determination that comes with that. What Brenda is bringing to us is the opportunity to have a panel discussion on April 25th mm-hmm. at the First Reformed Church in the Stockade.
Yeah, great place.
Great, beautiful, beautiful
yeah,
venue.
Yeah.
And we are going to have a panel discussion. Community leaders are going to be involved. Folks
raising
that are currently
yeah.
raising the awareness, and not only raising the awareness, but what are some solutions? What are we all going to walk out of that room with and be able to affect a true change?
After 45 minutes or so, I'm about to go on. I'll be interviewed by longtime host producer Ann Perillo, Proctor's 2018 Volunteer of the Year, and a recipient of the City of Schenectady's Patroon Award. Here's an abbreviated version of that segment.
And here we are back again. And with me is my friend, Garrett McCary. I've known him for a long time. He's come to my rescue a number of times with television. So anyway, here we are talking about eels. Who would have thought of that?
We're doing a little experiment with this
We're
segment,
doing an
aren't
experiment,
we?
Experiment, yes.
I'm working with the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, and they have a radio
great
station.
Great place, great place.
It's called WOOC. But they do a nightly program called the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. So I propose to them that we take a little segment of your program, which is all community, as we
right.
know.
Right, yeah, you can tell. We did the law and we've done everything
we've
here.
Done, you did everything yeah. here. And that we take one segment a week and we put it on there. Can you give me a little bit of history of what this program is?
Oh, well, you're watching Schenectady Today in and around the Capital Region. We've been on the air going in our 21st year. And we really enjoy meeting new people, new guests, and promoting the Capital Region, the entire Capital Region.
You could be the longest running community program in the country.
I'm glad you didn't say oldest, but.
longest running. Well, that goes without saying. Okay, so folks, for the radio audience, that's what you're listening to, Ann Perillo, who is a marvelous host. I'm so happy that she's able to participate in this experiment.
Always fun.
Okay, so let's talk about eels.
Yeah, let's talk about eels. Who would have thought eels? And then when you tell me they come from the Bermuda Triangle area all the way up the Hudson, those guys must really like to swim.
They really like to swim. Yeah, the life cycle of an eel is very interesting because unlike salmon and striped bass and herring, which live in the ocean and come up and they spawn in the freshwater.
And then they die.
Some of them die, but yeah. you know, the stripers yeah. don't.
Somebody has to live.
But yeah, somebody has to live. The eels actually live in freshwater in your ponds and lakes and streams and creeks. And then after about 8 or 9 years, they decide, it's time to go spawn.
So they live quite a long time then, if they don't get eaten.
If they don't get eaten, yes. And in this country, we don't eat eels very much, but in Europe, it's a delicacy, and of course, in Japan, it is.
But so they're bigger. They don't. These are little eels.
Let me finish my story.
So the
eels all swim down on some dark night in September. You can get thousands of eels swimming back to the Sargasso Sea, 1,500 miles away. And so no one really knows exactly where, but you have to picture this now, a giant eel ball somewhere in the middle of the ocean where they're all laying eggs, sperm.
Yeah, and then it's a love fest.
It's an eel love fest. You'd think Woodstock was something. This is eel stock. So then they lay the eggs, and the eggs kind of swim around a bit, and then they hatch into these little baby glass eels. And they're called
glass eels.
Glass eels, yeah. And you can see through them. And then they swim back up, all the way up the Hudson, all the way up every little creek, and they do this in the springtime. So the DEC, the Department of Environmental Conservation, has been doing a program for about 10 years now where they have been capturing eels in all the tributaries of the Hudson and counting them and then releasing them because they just want to get a base
information. Yeah, to find out how many are coming through.
What's going on.
Now I'm a little confused because these are freshwater eels, did you say?
They're freshwater eels, yes.
Well, but they spawn, go through the ocean.
But they spawn in the ocean.
So they're both saltwater and freshwater. They're
exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So anyway, so these little eels come up and we capture them, and we're trying to get a base as to how many eels there are. And also, it could be like an indicator species, so that if...
Yeah, like frogs.
Like frogs are in the world right now, and the old canary in the coal mine, of what's going on with the environment.
Exactly.
And so we are actually having a meeting on April 16th at the Mount Ida Preservation Hall, which is on Congress Street in Troy. It's the old church up there.
You're going to give a presentation?
And no, the DEC is coming up.
Okay.
And they're actually going to bring some eels, because the eels are coming up the river. They're just not all the way up here yet. So we're hoping that this the Post and Kill station will become a permanent station
every year.
Because it is the last major tributary before the locks. And as I say, it's fun to do. It changes with the tide. You can only get the net in low tide. So every day there's a different time.
Based on tide.
And we're going to do it for like a month or 6 weeks, according to how many eels we get.
It's exciting.
It is very exciting. Yeah.
Who thought about you ever think you'd be counting eels?
No.
We've been talking with Garrett McCary, and he's an eel counter. I guess you could say that.
Eel counter. Okay. Marshmallow maker, eel counter, whatever you want to call me.
For more information on how you can be a guest or an audience member or on the crew, go to SchenectadyToday.com or message Ann Perillo on Facebook. To learn more about the Eel Project on the Post and Kill, come to Mount Ida Preservation Hall, 548 Congress Street, Troy, on Tuesday, April 16th at 5:30 p.m. or email aiden.mabey, that's A-I-D-A-N dot M-A-B-E-Y, at dec.ny.gov. Learn how you can get involved. Hey, it's time to get in the water.
Thank you, Garrett and Anne. Hopefully all of you at home will find a newfound appreciation for the humble eel.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Amy Loria.
And I'm Eric Newton. Our engineer tonight is Felix McGuy. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.